In his report on salinization, Liu Jiangsun noted that in many counties in northern Henan, the extent of salinization had doubled, reaching as high as 28%. Hu Yaobong, inspecting counties along the Yellow River, found that huge irrigation schemes in some counties in Shandong had increased the overall proportion of alkaline soil from 8% to as much as 24%. This was confirmed in a more detailed report on the northern and western parts of the province, where an average salinization was above 20% by 1962, having doubled since the Great Leap Forward. In Hui Min County, it was close to half of all cultivated land. There was little doubt about the reasons for this. Over the last couple of years, the development of irrigation schemes has disturbed the natural drainage system. How many millions of hectares were lost to salt during the Great Famine is not clear, but it is likely to have reached 10 to 15% of all irrigated cropland. No nationwide or even provincial figures exist, but qualitative evidence suggests that air and water pollution also contributed to an environmental crisis of considerable proportions. China had no treatment plants, and both urban sewage and industrial waste were discharged directly into local rivers. In the drive to transform a predominantly agricultural society into an industrial powerhouse capable of leading the socialist camp in its conquest of the world, the amount of pollutants such as phenol, cyanide, arsenic, fluorines, nitrates and sulfates released into water streams surged. Phenol is one of the most common contaminants. 0.001 milligrams per liter is advisable for drinking water and 0.01 for farming fish. In spillages in the Songhua and Mudan rivers, which flow through the bleak industrial heartland of the north, the amount of phenol ranged from 2 to 24 milligrams per liter. Where carp, catfish and sturgeon once teemed, nothing but a noisome flow of toxic materials remained. In a 150-kilometer stretch of the Nern River, a major tributary of the Songhua, some 600 tons of dead fish were removed by fishermen in less than a day in the spring of 1959. In Liaoning, fish disappeared completely from the rivers near the industrial cities of Fushun and Shenyang. Along the coast near Dalian, it was not unusual to harvest some 20 tons of sea cucumber each year, but the delicacy vanished during the Great Leap Forward. Further south, in Beijing, the state council complained about pollution. The powerful Anshan iron and steel complex discharged such large amounts of waste that the rivers reeked of petrol, with dead fish floating belly up on the slimy surface. So great was the amount of alkaline waste released by paper mills in Jiamusi that even the bottoms of boats corroded. The mills themselves were no longer able to produce high-quality paper because they relied on the river water they so heavily polluted. This was the case for all factories in the belt stretching from Shanghai down to Hangzhou. Oil companies were also culprits. A single plant in Maoming releasing 24,000 tons of kerosene into rivers each year. Other scarce resources in the midst of famine were emptied into the water, smelting plants in dirty, dusty Shenyang, the state council calculated, could have saved 240 tons of copper and 590 tons of sulfuric acid a year, simply by recycling the water they used. Few comparative studies were made at the time to measure the increase of pollution after 1957, but one case study illustrates the impact of the Great Leap Forward. The leather, knitting, paper and chemical factories in Lanzhou, the industrial centre of the northwest, generated some 1,680 tons of waste water a day in 1957. This had rocketed up to 12,750 tons a day by 1959. Lanzhou is the first large city along the Yellow River, which contained eight times more pollutants than was allowed by the Ministry of Hygiene. the river slowly wound its way through the deserts and grasslands of Inner Mongolia before entering the North China Plain, where the water was diverted for irrigation through endless conduits and culverts, the pollutants becoming embedded deep in the cultivated soil. People, too, were poisoned, as rivers were often the only source of drinking water. Workers living near steel plants in the north suffered from chronic poisoning. In Zibo, Shandong, 100 farmers became ill after drinking water polluted with contaminants from a pharmaceutical factory upstream. In Nanjing, a single factory employing a mere 275 workers produced 80 to 90 tons of sewage, containing radioactive material each day. No measures for waste disposal existed, and all of it was dumped straight down the drain, ending up in the Tsinghua River, which turned into a cesspool. Even groundwater was poisoned. Used by local people to wash their rice, the water in the wells near the factory turned red or green. In Baoshan, Shanghai, the wastewater produced by steel plants leached into workers' dormitories. Outside, heaps of corrugated iron waste accumulated, so that workers had to climb over the rubbish to gain access to their sleeping quarters. While slag was of less concern compared to pollution caused by waste discharges, 250,000 tons accumulated every day in busy Shanghai. The air, too, was polluted, although we have fewer specific examples, since water was a far more precious resource than air, and thus was monitored in greater detail. But one study shows that in Shanghai, the equivalent of 20 tons of sulfuric acid mist created in the production of phosphate fertilizers was spewed into the air each day by a number of factories. Some of these factories also produced pesticides, which contaminated animals, people, soil, and air. In Shanghai, for instance, thousands of tons of Dipterex and DDT were produced, as well as benzene hexachloride, BHC, a highly toxic farm chemical labeled 666, which degraded only slowly in the soil. The effects of pesticides on livestock, agricultural land, and aquatic products are well known. But in times of famine, chemical poison found new applications, spreading far beyond the farm. Desperate for food, some communes used pesticides to catch fish, birds, and animals. In Hubei, insecticides such as Sistox and Dematon, commonly called 1605 and 1059 powders, as well as hypertoxic pesticide known as 3911, were deliberately spread to capture ducks, which were then sold to the cities. In Shako alone, dozens of customers were poisoned and several died after eating the contaminated fowl. Famished farmers also foraged independently for food, releasing chemicals in ponds and lakes to kill the wildlife. In some places, the water turned green, killing all. But the most popular form of pest control was mass mobilization. Enthralled by the power of the masses to conquer nature, Mao had raised the call to eliminate rats, flies, mosquitoes, and sparrows in 1958. Sparrows were targeted because they ate grain seeds, depriving the people of the fruits of their labor. In what is one of the most bizarre and ecologically damaging episodes of the Great Leap Forward, the country was mobilized in an all-out war against the birds. Banging on drums, clashing pots, or beating gongs, a giant din was raised to keep the sparrows flying till they were so exhausted that they simply dropped from the sky. Eggs were broken and nestlings destroyed. The birds were also shot out of the air. Timing was of the essence, as the entire country was made to march in lockstep in the battle against the enemy, making sure that the sparrows had nowhere to escape. In cities, people took to the roofs, while in the countryside, farmers dispersed to the hillsides and climbed trees in the forests, all at the same hour to ensure complete victory. Soviet expert Mikhail Klochko witnessed the beginning of the campaign in Beijing. he was awakened in the early morning by the blood-curdling screams of a woman running to and fro on the roof of a building next to his hotel. A drum started beating as the woman frantically waved a large sheet tied to a bamboo pole. For 3 days, the entire hotel was mobilized in the campaign to do away with sparrows, from bellboys and maids to the official interpreters. Children came out with slings, shooting at any kind of winged creature. Accidents happened as people fell from roofs, poles, and ladders. In Nanjing, Li Haodong climbed on the roof of a school building to get a sparrow's nest, only to lose his footing and tumble down 3 floors. Local carder He Delin, furiously waving a sheet to scare the birds, tripped and fell from a rooftop, breaking his back. Guns were deployed to shoot at birds, also resulting in accidents. In Nanjing, some 330 kilos of gunpowder were used in a mere 2 days, indicating the extent of the campaign. But the real victim was the environment, as guns were taken to any kind of feathered creature. The extent of damage was exacerbated by the indiscriminate use of farm poison. In Nanjing, bait killed wolves, rabbits, snakes, lambs, chicken, ducks, dogs, and pigeons, some in large quantities. The main casualty was the humble sparrow. We do not have any reliable figures, as numbers were part of a campaign in which rhetorical inflation combined with specious precision to produce digits as surreal as the campaign itself. Shanghai thus triumphantly reported that it had eliminated 48,695.49 kilos of flies, 930,486 rats, 1,213.5 kilos of cockroaches, and 1,367,440 sparrows in one of their periodic wars against all pests. One wonders how many people secretly bred flies or cockroaches to obtain a medal of honour. Sparrows were probably driven to near extinction, and few were seen for years afterwards. By April 1960, as the leaders realized that the birds also ate insects, they were removed from the list of harmful pests and bedbugs substituted instead. But the reversal came too late. Insect infestation spread after 1958, ruining a significant proportion of the crop. The biggest damage was done before the harvest, as swarms of locusts would obscure the sky and cover the countryside under a bristling blanket, devouring the crop. Taking advantage of the drought in Hebei in the summer of 1961, they infested some 13,000 hectares in the Xiaogan region alone. In the Jingzhou region, more than 50,000 hectares were devastated. Overall in the province, some 15% of the rice crop was lost to the voracious grasshopper. Everything was stripped bare, over half of all cotton being lost in the Yichang region. Around Nanjing, where a ferocious campaign had been fought against sparrows, some 60% of all fields suffered from insect damage in the autumn of 1960, which led to severe shortages of vegetables. All sorts of harmful species thrived. In Zhejiang province, 500,000 to 750,000 tons of grain, or roughly 10% of the harvest, were lost in 1960 to snout moth, leafhopper, pink bollworm, and red spider, among other pests. Preventative measures were hampered by lack of insecticide. Farm chemicals had first been squandered in the assault on nature in 1958-9, and then shortages of all commodities extended by 1960 to pesticides, just as they were needed more than ever. In the war on nature, different factors thus combined to amplify dramatically what the leadership described as natural catastrophes. The steel campaign caused deforestation, leading in turn to soil erosion and water loss. Grandiose irrigation schemes further disturbed the ecological balance, worsening the impact of inundations and droughts, both of which were drivers of locusts. Drought eliminated all competition, while the heavy rains that followed allowed locusts to hatch more quickly than other insects and take over a mauled landscape. Because sparrows had vanished and pesticides had been misused, the insects descended unopposed on whatever meagre crop the farmers had managed to grow. Mao lost his war against nature. The campaign backfired by breaking the delicate balance between humans and the environment, decimating human life as a result. Part 4. Survival. Chapter 22. Feasting through famine. Equality may have been a pillar of communist ideology, but all communist states built elaborate hierarchical orders on the ground. One reason for this was that most of these regimes lived in constant fear of real or imagined enemies, justifying the regimentation of society along military lines in which each subordinate unit was expected to carry out orders without questioning. Each official is the anvil of his superiors and the hammer of his subordinates. Another reason was that the command economy distributed goods and services according to need rather than demand, and the needs of different groups were assigned different priorities by the party, whether the country was defending the realm against imperialist powers or busy building a communist future. In the People's Republic, access to food, goods and services was largely determined by a household registration system, the rough equivalent of the internal passport instituted in December 1932 in the Soviet Union. Introduced to the cities in 1951, it was extended to the countryside in 1955 and became law in 1958, just when farmers were being pitchforked into communes. It divided people into two separate worlds by classing them either as city dwellers, chumin, or as peasants, nongmin. The status conferred by the registration system was inherited through the mother, meaning that even if a village girl married a city dweller, she and her children remained farmers. The household registration system was a linchpin of the planned economy. As the state was in charge of the distribution of goods, it had to have a rough idea of the needs of different sectors of the economy. If large flows of people moved about the country in complete freedom, it would upset the production quotas and distribution charts so meticulously mapped by central planners. But another function of the system was to tie the cultivators to the land, making sure that cheap labor was available in the collective farms from which a surplus was taken to pay for industrialization. Farmers were treated as an hereditary caste deprived of the privileges given to city dwellers, which included subsidized housing, food rations, and access to health, education, and disability benefits. In the midst of famine, the state left farmers to fend for themselves. A war was created between cities and the countryside, but an equally important fault line ran between ordinary people and party members. And within the party, as in the army, an elaborate internal hierarchy further determined the privileges to which one was entitled, from the amount of grain, sugar, cooking oil, meat, fowl, fish, and fruit, to the quality of durable goods, housing, health care, and access to information. Even the quality of cigarettes varied according to rank. In Guangzhou in 1962, carders of ranks 8 and 9 received 2 cartons of ordinary cigarettes a month. Carders of ranks 4 to 7, 2 better quality cartons, while the highest 3 ranks, reserved for top intellectuals, artists, scientists and party leaders, received 3 cartons of the finest quality. At the apex of the party stood the leadership, who had special residences ensconced behind high walls, security guards round the clock and chauffeured cars. Special shops with scarce goods at discounted prices were reserved for them and their families. Dedicated farms produced high-quality vegetables, meat, chicken and eggs, which were analyzed for freshness and tested for poison before being sampled by tasters. Only then was the food served to leaders in the capital and the provinces. Above them was Mao, living in opulence near the Forbidden City, where emperors had once dwelled, his bedroom the size of a ballroom. Sumptuous villas, staffed with chefs and attendants all year round, were at his beck and call in every province or major city. At the bottom of the scale were the millions locked away in labour camps located in the harshest parts of the countryside, from the bitterly cold plains of Manchuria to the arid deserts of Gansu. They were made to break stones, dig for coal, carry bricks, or plough the desert for years on end without any recourse to the law. As the famine developed, the ranks of the privileged swelled. Despite continuous purges, the party membership increased by almost half, from 12.45 million in 1958 to 17.38 million in 1961. Party members knew how to take good care of themselves. One way to feast through famine was to attend frequent meetings, where everything was provided for by the state. Some 50,000 officials came to Shanghai in 1958, a number which had doubled to 100,000 by 1960. They stayed in state-run hotels and dined at state-sponsored banquets. A favourite haunt was the Donghu Hotel, former residence of the famous gangster Du Yuesheng. It was one of the few venues not to charge for anything at all, whether elaborate menus or a range of perfumes on offer in the toilets. Some of these conferences lasted for over a month. In 1960, roughly one high-level conference was held every day of the year, at great cost to the city. Lower-ranking cadres feasted at local meetings. In Nanyang County, in famine-ravaged Guizhou Province, 260 cadres spent 4 days working through 210 kilos of beef, 500 kilos of pork, 680 chickens, 40 kilos of ham, 130 litres of wine, and 79 cartons of cigarettes, as well as mountains of sugar and pastries. To that had to be added fine blankets, luxury pillows, perfumed soap, and other goods specifically purchased for the conference. In Beijing, an automobile factory spent more than 6,000 yuan on 8 visits to top-class hotels to entertain visitors towards the end of 1960. Another ploy was to organize product testing sessions. In Yingkou, Liaoning, over 20 cadres convened one morning in March 1960, systematically working their way through a range of local produce, starting with cigarettes and moving on to tinned meat, fruit and biscuits, all the while helping themselves to copious portions of rice wine. By the end of the day, satiated and drunk, 3 of the testers had vomited. Pleasure trips were organized. In February 1960, some 250 cadres boarded a luxury ship to cruise the Yangtze, sampling culinary delights on board while admiring limestone cliffs, karst landscapes and small gorges, occasionally leaving the comfort of their cabins to visit cultural highlights along the way. 100 rolls of film were shot. The scent of perfumed oils and incense sticks, thoughtfully positioned throughout the vessel, wafted through the air. A steady stream of high-heeled waitresses in new uniforms served dish after dish of delicacies. A band played in the background. No expense was spared. For fuel and staff alone, the 25-day cruise cost some 36,000 yuan, to which had to be added 5 tons of meat and fish, not counting endless supplies of cigarettes and alcohol. It must have been a mesmerizing sight, as the cruiser was illuminated like a rainbow with lights of every colour, dazzling in the darkness of a moonlit night. The sound of laughter, chatter and clinking of glasses travelled over the waters of the Yangtze, surrounded by a stunningly beautiful landscape, blighted by mass starvation. During the famine, the feasting and drinking, dachi daha, that took place in party meetings in the cities and the countryside, was a common source of complaint. Rapacious officials were often known as pigsy cadres, after the character in the famous Ming Dynasty novel Journey to the West, who was part human, part pig, and legendary for his laziness, gluttony, and lust. But outside the party, some ordinary people too had opportunities to feast. In the collective canteens, staff frequently abused their positions to pilfer the provisions. In one cotton factory in Zhengzhou, capital of famished Henan, those in charge regularly raided the storage room, using it as their personal larder. On one occasion, a cook gobbled down 20 salt eggs in a single day, and others ate their way through kilos of tinned meat. Noodles and fried dough cakes were eaten at night, while meat, fish and vegetables earmarked for the canteen were divided up among the team in daytime. Ordinary workers had to survive on 3 bowls of rice gruel a day, occasionally supplemented by some dry rice or a steamed bun. Many were too weak to work. In the countryside, villagers did not always stand idly by, watching the pillaging. In one commune in Guangdong, where 2/3 of all pigs had been eaten by local carders in banquets and feasts held to celebrate the advent of plenty, farmers warned, "You carders openly steal, we commune members secretly rob." An orgy of slaughter marked the countryside in 1958, when farmers killed off their poultry and livestock as a form of resistance against the people's communes. Spurred on by fear, rumour, and example, they opted to eat the fruits of their labour, or store up a supply of meat, or sell their assets on the black market and save some cash, rather than hand over their belongings. Hu Yongming, as we have seen, systematically ate his way through his livestock in a village up in the hilly northeast of Guangdong province, slaughtering in close succession 4 chickens, 3 ducks, dogs and puppies, as well as a cat. His family gorged themselves on the meat. But even after the heady days of 1958, villagers continued to find ways to have a treat occasionally, sometimes with the connivance of their local leaders. In Luoding, a county bloodied by a thuggish leadership, one brigade still managed to celebrate the birthday of the Communist Party, an excuse for each family to gulp down 4 ducks on the 1st of July, 1959. At Chinese New Year in 1961, thousands of farm cattle were slaughtered by disgruntled farmers in the Jiangxiang region, a form of protest also observed in other parts of Guangdong province, as no pork was available for the all-important dumplings traditionally used to celebrate the new lunar year. Another reason for the occasional feast was that few people saw any reason to save, as expropriation and inflation rapidly eroded any personal reserves. Chun Liugu, a thrifty old lady living in Panyu, had managed to save 300 yuan, but now splurged in the early summer of 1959, treating 10 people at a restaurant where bowls of fish soup were avidly consumed. "There is no use in saving money right now, and I only have 100 yuan left to buy a coffin." In Beijing, foreign residents noticed that some of the usually quiet restaurants did a roaring trade in 1959, as rumours about the advent of urban communes sent residents scrambling to sell their furniture in state-owned shops. The proceeds were spent on a rare meal in the restaurants. Sometimes ordinary people could eat copiously because they were lucky enough to be looked after by their carders, who used every political skill to turn their unit into a bastion of abundance in the midst of starvation. In Suhui, Shanghai, some canteens had the comparative luxuries of glass doors and fluorescent lamps fitted throughout. Others installed radios, while one canteen in Putuo built a basin with goldfish. On the other hand, poor supervision of the food supply chain in some urban units occasionally meant that workers had plenty to eat. In Hebei, an investigation showed that workers sometimes moved from one canteen to the next, eating their way through a series of meals. In one dining hall, the tables were routinely laden with produce which spilled over onto the floor. When the leftovers were swept up at the end of each session, 3 to 4 wash basins, weighing 5 kilos each, were filled. In a further case of an embarrassment of riches, Some workers took food back to their dormitories, although much of this was never eaten. The floor was covered in a layer of yellow mush as people trod on the discarded buns. In Shitsin Chan, just out